This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. You know, it takes all kinds of people to make up a community. Those people you see on your main streets are every age, and today we're going to focus on a particular age at the beginning of our show. The teenage years can be a challenge. Parents and teachers and coaches might sometimes wonder whether a teen is moody or dealing with something more serious. It can be hard to know the difference. Felicia Johnson is a youth mentor and mental health advocate, and she's the author of a trilogy of books inspired by her real-life experience with bipolar disorder and her best friend's challenges with borderline personality disorder. Recently, she visited with our Ashley Thornburg about her work.
Felicia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a trilogy of books that really dives into some topics that, let's just say, haven't been long-time dinner-time conversations. Why did you want to write about the topics that are in your books?
I think it's important for young people to connect with each other and understand one another, especially themselves. I wrote books that I wish I had when I was a kid, honestly. I wish I knew more about mental health issues when I was younger. You know, it was a kind of a taboo topic growing up. Not many people in my family wanted to talk about mental illness, even though it did run in our family. And it wasn't until I experienced it firsthand myself, being diagnosed with bipolar disorder at 15 years old and meeting other youth in therapy and learning about what mental illness is and that it's not a label. And that's why I write these books, to help educate not just the youth, but also families, friends, loved ones who struggle with mental illness.
Yeah, and when we say things like mental illness, mental health, I mean, people really need to understand that this is a spectrum here, and there can be good days, bad days, there can be severe cases, and there can be sort of very high functioning. So let's just talk about mental health as a spectrum. Why is it so important to focus in on that word spectrum?
I think mental health issues, just because it is like physical illness. You know, there are physical illnesses, there are mental health issues and mental illnesses. We have to take it as seriously as we do physical illness. You know, if someone breaks their arm, you're not going to sit there and say, oh, well, it'll just heal on its own. You're going to take them to the doctor, they're going to get it mended, and eventually it'll heal. And so it's the same with mental illness. We wouldn't want to ignore if we see that there's something wrong. We feel like something's wrong. So that's why it's really important that we do focus on it and give it just as much attention as we do with physical illness.
Yeah, you mentioned your own diagnosis with bipolar at just age 15. And, of course, we do this thing like you get an arm broken, you go to the emergency room, you have depression, and people say, get over it. Who was your advocate?
Myself, actually. I unfortunately, you know, my childhood was a bit rough. I did grow up in an abusive home. And that's another one of the topics I speak about when I advocate that, you know, abuse in any way, shape, or form, whether it's physical, mental, spiritual, verbal, any type of abuse is damaging, and it can cause trauma, mental health, and mental health issues. So that's what led to my mental health issues, and when I just wasn't responding well to life, and when I was pulled out of that situation suddenly, you know, I noticed that my behavior was just erratic. I was experiencing typical, like, mood swings that I thought was typical, like teenage stuff, but no, I mean, I would go from 0 to 100 in like 60 seconds, and I struggled with self-harming behavior. These are all symptoms that just can't, if they manifested and they were just not normal behaviors. So what had to happen was I had to ask for help, because I scared myself one day. I knew that this behavior was just not right. And so I had to ask for help on my own.
What do you mean when you say you scared yourself one day?
I scared myself one day. Like, I was into self-harming behavior, so that's how I learned to cope after being pulled out of that abusive situation suddenly. When the abuse stopped, it was very confusing to me. It was just, I mean, being told every day that this is the norm, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you got to keep the secret, these shameful things inside. So I didn't really feel like I had anybody to talk to, so my outlet was self-harming. And it wasn't to try to take my own life, but one day it did go too far. And that's how I ended up scaring myself and saying, okay, I have to get some help.
The books in the trilogy talking about topics like borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, self-injury, suicidal thoughts. Was this a kind of therapy for you?
Absolutely. I've been journaling since I was 6 years old, and writing saved my life. And I know that sounds weird, but writing is what got me through the abuse because, like I said, there was nobody really I could talk to. So my journals were always my sort of best friends. And I just continue to journal to this day, like I said, since I was six. And somehow these journals, just once I started going to school and learning about clinical psychology and earning my degree and started working in the mental health field, helping people, I realized I could do more with it by taking my education, and putting the information out there, the educational tools and that people can read and actually relate to. So I chose fiction because I like fiction. It tells a story. It guides you through. And when you're inside of the mind of a character who's struggling with, you know, mental health issues, self-image issues, anything like that, you're in their head, you're learning, and as they're healing, you're healing. And so I try to write the books, I write the books in fiction so that people can sort of relate to it, but the books tend to have a heart of a textbook, I guess, because there's clinical information actually written into the pages. So as the character, again, like I said, character's breaking down, you're breaking down with them as they're learning and they're in their treatment, you're in the treatment with them, and you begin to see their mind change as they heal and go into recovery. So that's my sort of my formula. You know, everybody sort of comes out in the end with a lesson learned. It's not always sunshine and rainbows, I'm not saying that, but there's something to learn from it. There's a whole point to the stories.
Yeah, boy, it almost sounds a little like when parents have to sneak vegetables into food that they know their kids will like. Because there's power there in somebody who thinks that something is normal or knows that something isn't normal but doesn't have the words to define it. There's right. There's such a powerful connection there when you open a book and you feel like this person gets you.
Exactly.
What did you learn about yourself when you were going through this process? Did anything surprise you?
Yeah, I learned that I wasn't alone. And I felt so alone for so long, just being silent, you know, being scared. There's a lot of shame that comes with, you know, being an abuse survivor. And you're used to just keeping these secrets for so long that you just feel alone. So when I joined, you know, group therapy for survivors of abuse and domestic violence, I just sat back, and for weeks I just listened to people before I even spoke, and it was just interesting. That was one of the biggest lessons I learned, is that I'm not alone. And I still have to keep telling myself that, because I tell other people that, and it's just so important.
How do you feel about your experience with the mental health process in this country?
I learned that it's a global issue. It's not just here in America. You know, I've traveled around the world, and I meet so many people who've read my books in, you know, the UK, South Africa, even in Japan, and it's all over the world. It's not even just this country. So I feel like it's a community effort, It takes a community effort to better improve our education first, educating people about mental health issues, just like we do in school. They have physical education class, health classes. I think mental health education should be included with that as well. And then when it comes to treatment and care, make it a little more easily accessible for people who need it. That way, you know, if we just keep talking about it and pushing to advocate, that stigma that's on it, that's on mental health issues, can sort of start to fade away.
So who are your readers? Are you writing sort of specifically for people who are somewhere on the mental health illness spectrum? Are you writing for the people who are living with them? Maybe they're the siblings, maybe they're the parents, some of each?
I write for everyone, anyone who's looking to educate themselves. I think that's the greatest gift we can give to ourselves is education, and stop the ignorance that's behind, you know, the stigma that mental health issues carry. That was my problem growing up. There was no, people were afraid to talk about it. People didn't want to talk about it, even though it existed and it was there. It just couldn't be ignored for so long. So my audience, I hope, are people who are looking to educate themselves, people who may need to want to understand themselves or someone that they love or care about, or who just want to know more about these issues that are going on out there. So really, it's for anybody looking to educate themselves.
We're visiting with Felicia Johnson. She is a mental health advocate and author. The website's FeliciaJohnsonAuthor.com. Felicia, you've written a trilogy of novels here, and the first one, Her, talks about borderline personality disorder, primarily stemming from an event that happened in your childhood life when you had a friend who did commit suicide, and later it was found out that she did have borderline personality disorder. And Kristen, in your novel, hurts herself. What is borderline personality disorder?
Simply put, it has to do with emotional dysregulation, and symptoms can include like instability in interpersonal relationships, a skewed self-image, market impulsivity, and that self-harming behavior we talked about, a lot of compulsive behaviors. And it's like I said, it has to do with emotional dysregulation. That's the simplest way to put it.
Who's Mr. Sharp in this book?
So Mr. Sharp is a character that Kristen, the main character, he is her mental, he's the physical form of her mental illness. She has borderline personality disorder, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder due to the abuse that she suffered and being pulled out of that situation suddenly. And Mr. Sharp is what gets her through. So instead of writing, I wanted to use an image, like a person, like an addiction. Instead of describing her self-harming, it's like she's having a conversation with her own mental illness. And I think that's how people can sort of relate to it when you've, you know, got that bully on your back telling you that you're no good, that you're, you know, a loser. That's what Mr. Sharp does for her. But then he also builds her back up. So a person who, you know, might do drugs to make themselves feel better, it's still hurting them, but they're getting the high that they feel like they need in order to survive. So that's what Mr. Sharp is to her. He's her addiction. He's her mental illness. He's the manifestation of the things that have traumatized her from her past.
How did you do your research for these novels?
A lot of it came from personal experience in journals, just journaling, and people I've met, and people who want to share pieces of their lives and things that they've gone through, because there are so many characters in these books, and they're all related. They all tie together. And they don't really feel like they have a voice. So I have friends and, you know, even clinicians, people I work with who, you know, ask me, is it okay if you include this or that and put pieces of this from my life in your book? And, and we all relate to each other. And so, yeah, that's how I get my material, just by going by real life issues and putting them all together.
You've mentioned your own issues and, of course, Holly and the issues that she faced in her life. I'm a former teenage girl. I have a teenage girl. Of course, all of my female friends are former teenage girls. So,
right.
You know, we're speaking primarily from a female perspective here. But you've sort of used this phrase before, like the normal teenager experience. And definitely as an adult, I have sort of learned that I know precious few people who didn't at some point look to self-harm or think about taking those pills or maybe even take a few, just enough, and very easily roundly dismissed as sort of normal teenager things. What I know, this is not an easy line to draw, and it's certainly not a straight line to draw, but for people who have young people in their lives, what are some of the, no, this one really is normal teenager, they're going to be mad, they're going to slam doors, and where do you really want to start saying, okay, let's go next
level
with this?
You definitely want to always keep a dialogue open. I mean, you don't want to wait until someone is scared. You know, like in my case, I'm not going to say exactly what happened, but again, I was self-harming, and it got to the point where I scared myself, and you don't ever want it to get to that point. So if you're talking constantly and keeping a dialogue open, you'll see the changes. You know your child. Your child should, they're growing to know who they are themselves, and if, in my experience, if my guardians at the time, the people who were looking out for me, had noticed the scars on my arms, or that I was wearing long sleeves and, you know, baggy clothes in the middle of summer, you know, those are things that weren't normal for me, but suddenly now I'm doing that. So had they paid attention, maybe they, and a dialogue had been open, they would have maybe questioned me about it and said, hey, why are you always wearing sweaters and, you know, long baggy pants in the summer? You know, that's not what you do. So when you see these changes after a dialogue's already been open, I think that dialogue should continue. Don't ignore the changes when you see them.
Do you get a lot of good dialogue from your readers? Do they write to you and talk about your books and their experience?
Yes, they do a lot, especially on social media. On my Facebook page, on my Twitter, I mean, it's great. And they connect together. That's another great thing. That's what I was talking about earlier, about how this is a community effort, everybody feeling like they're in a safe space together to share and feel like they're not alone and give that validation to somebody else that they're not alone.
What do you do as a youth mentor?
As a youth mentor, I go up to, it's a place called Inner Harbor Youth Villages, and there are children who are inpatient, and a lot of them are in the system, and they don't have, you know, adults like parents or brothers and sisters to come visit them, aunts or uncles. And so what youth mentors do there is we voluntarily go up there, and we visit with the youth, and we're assigned, you know, our own kids. And we visit them like we're family. And what I try to do is I'm typically given the older, angrier kids for some reason.
Oh,
I think
I'm sorry.
Because of my own background.
Yeah.
But I would bring like job applications up there, teach them how to fill them out, and you know, try to prepare them mentally for when they're going to be released from the hospital, because it's long term treatment hospital. So some of the kids are there, you know, until they turn 18 sometimes, and I want them to know that they can have a good life beyond those walls, that once they're out, they don't have to continue to rely on the system just because they have mental health issues, that they can also be successful and pursue their dreams.
Sure. Does any of the work that you do, and realizing that you're not a medical professional, but does any of the work that you do, you know, sort of encompass the holistic approach to well-being? Is there physical activity, you know, in addition to focusing in on the mental health part?
Yeah, I think it all comes together. I mean, there's so many great activities that one can use to cope. Like, for me, I love exercising. I love meditating. I mean, these are things that keep my mind active and keep my body healthy. When you eat the right foods and, you know, you start to feel good, you know. A lot of what we put in our bodies has a lot to do with how we feel, too. So just looking out for how we eat, exercising, and music. I love music. So, So yeah, you know, there are so many things that help with mental health, wellness, and balance.
Well, you've mentioned, I think, a few things that are probably factors in my next question here, but your overall mental health regimen now, how would you describe your approach to being your best self?
For me personally, it's just knowing that I'm here, I'm not alone, and that I'm doing what I love to do, and that's help people 24/7. If I wasn't doing the work that I'm doing, helping people, I have no idea what I would be doing. Knowing that I'm a survivor, well, I'm beyond survivor. I like to call it life thriver, because when you've gone beyond, you know, being a victim, when you're not a victim anymore, you've accepted that you survived something, and now you're doing something great, and you're using that past not as an excuse to not do well, but to do better and help others. I think that's when you become a life thriver. So that's reminding myself of that, and listening to other people's stories, and speaking and writing is just it. That's what keeps me balanced.
What's next for you?
Well, I got the last book of Danny Boy trilogy coming out. Okay, Danny Boy is a spinoff of her. So the character, main character Daniel, is one of the supporting characters in her, and that's his spinoff. He's got the two books out already, 1 and 2, Chaos and Monster, and then Okay, Danny Boy Volume 3, Love, comes out August 31st, 2018.
Felicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Felicia Johnson, author of Her, A Look at Borderline Personality Disorder, and the 2-volume Danny Boy books on bipolar disorder, talking with our Ashley Thornburg. You can read more about Johnson's work at FeliciaJohnsonAuthor.com. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern and a Natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura. Our Bill Thomas interviews David Borlaug about the Capitol Gallery in Bismarck, and Bill will also update us on Prairie Public's Ask a Native American project. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Grand Forks man who ran for Secretary of State in the June primary as a Libertarian is asking the North Dakota Supreme Court to order a recount in his race. Roland Reimers was the only Libertarian on the ballot. State law says a party needs 300 votes in the primary to have its own column on the general election ballot.
I lost by 53 votes, and I'm not only off the general election ballot, but this loses us our status as a Libertarian party for the next 2 years, because we have no other candidates on the ballot for Secretary of State. So the effort of the recount is to define these 53 more votes to get me back on the ballot.
Reimers told the Supreme Court as he reads the state law, he's entitled to a recount.
That basically says if I lost the nomination, which I obviously did, and if that was by 1% or less of the top vote getter and for that office, which would have been Will Gardner, and he had 54,000 votes, or 1% was 540 votes, then it was mandated that the state do a recount.
Will Gardner was in the Republican column. The attorney representing Secretary of State Al Jaeger told the court the statute was only meant for contested races. And for the primary, that meant a contested race for the nomination. But Reimers was the only Libertarian running. The high court is studying the case. Following complaints by Fargo property owners about high tax bills after the city changed the special assessment formula, city leaders said they would look for a fix. That fix may be coming. City commissioners voted unanimously to form a special assessment task force that will recommend changes in the way the city pays for infrastructure. Here's Commissioner Tony Grinberg.
That is, all options would be on the table, not just one or two, but in particular with the news last week with the potential state legislative funding coming our way. It's a game changer. You know, that in itself will have profound effect on what we go about with our business. So I don't think we can say it's just one or two. This could be a number of things. I know there's been some studies with other options in Omaha and Sioux Falls. So I don't think we can just say one or two for sure. I think there could be many.
The 13-member task force will have 11 voting members appointed by Mayor Tim Mahoney. Commissioners Tony Grinberg and Tony Gehrig will be non-voting members. It will include six private citizens and representatives of the Realtors and Home Builders Association, the Chamber, a banker, a mortgage expert, and a developer. Those interested are asked to contact a city commissioner. Names must be received by August 5th. The task force will present its recommendations to the city commission in December. And a new state revenue forecast will be released in August.
We call it our preliminary forecast because it's our first preliminary look at the next biennium.
Joe Morissette is the director of the state's Office of Management and Budget.
We'll use it as the basis for a lot of the decisions that we make as we prepare the executive budget.
Morissette says OMB has been working with Moody's Analytics and recently convened a revenue advisory group to look at Moody's numbers. He says the advisory group didn't make many changes.
It's going to be fairly conservative. We're just kind of working through the mechanics of how we factor in other changes, exactly how the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will affect our revenue based on our tax law here.
Morissette says the forecast will be updated in the fall before Governor Burgum presents his executive budget recommendations to the legislature in its December organizational session. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Tom is also the author and the voice of the Plainsfolk essays you hear on Main Street. Today, his title is Game of Football.
In May 1887, the Griggs Courier of Cooperstown reported that Mrs. Beebe was a good deal annoyed with the gang of boys creating a nuisance in her neighborhood. Confronting them in the street, she had tried entreaties and threats to no purpose, it was reported, until the other day when she had her innings. Innings. The editor's metaphor is mixed up because the game the boys were playing in the street and incidentally trespassing on Mrs. Beebe's residential property was not cricket, but this new game, football, they called it. The boys had the habit of hopping Mrs. Beebe's fence when the oblong rubber ball flew into her yard, until the old woman pounced on it and took it into her house, shutting down the game. Deputations of boys called on her every half hour, entreating for return of the ball, but Mrs. Beebe rejected their pleas, until finally giving it back to them at 8 p.m. Now, believe it or not, there was a time when our prairie towns faced the advent of autumn without benefit of Friday night lights. The rise of American football as an offshoot of English rugby took place during our territorial period of settlement. A key element in the game's emergence was the codification of American rules for the game by Walter Camp, who played and coached at Yale University. In our railroad towns on the prairies, our boys followed the heroics of Camp's Yaleys and the other teams at the Eastern colleges, and they were not slow to get in on the action. We can trace the stirrings of football fever in Dakota Territory through its newspapers. And the first reference I find is a report in May 1883 that Doc Phillip of Hope had sustained a severe, though not dangerous, cut over the eye while indulging in a game of football with the boys. I imagine Doc Phillip gazing ruefully into the mirror as he stitches himself up, resolving thereafter to act his age. A month later, I read in the Jamestown Alert, "The town of Carrington have the honor to challenge the city of Jamestown to a game of football to be played at Carrington on the 4th day of July, 1883. Carrington to furnish the ball. All communications to be addressed to football in care of J. Morley Wired, editor of the Carrington News." Was this, perhaps, the first inter-city game of football played in Dakota Territory? Local historians call me out on this. In the West River, you might think the boys would be busy roping calves and busting broncs for their bruises, but no. Medora's Badlands Cowboy reports in April 1885, football and baseball are becoming popular sports among the boys. A football game was played in Williamsburg, Emmons County, on the 4th of July, 1886. They also had baseball, a sack race, and a game of quoits, spelled with a Q. Look that one up yourself. Huron had a football club in 1883, and in 1888 it was reported that the boys in Yankton were taking advantage of the town's new electric lights to play on the street at night. Although not yet a school sport, football was a boys' or young man's game, except when, like Doc Phillip, the old guys just could not contain themselves, reported the Turner County Herald of Hurley in 1887. "A number of old soldier boys engaged in a game of football last Saturday, and it was surprising to see the alacrity with which the lame and the blind followed the ball around the grounds. Thankfully, I know my limitations and act my age, in matters athletic, at least."
That's Tom Ezern. He'll be featured on tomorrow's Main Street, too. We'll talk about his new book, Pacing Dakota, and we'll tell you about a Missouri River cruise we're planning to give Tom's readers a chance to meet him. Next on Main Street, our Bill Thomas takes us inside the Capitol Gallery in Bismarck.
Before highways, there were trails, and the Red Trail hails back to 1914. The Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson honors the early days of automobile travel. When you drive the Old Red Old 10, you will travel the same routes, have the same excitement, and meet the same friendly people as did the early motorists. More information about Old Highway 10 and Red Trail online at oldredold10.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Bill Thomas. He's our director of radio, and he's been in Bismarck doing a number of things, including visiting galleries. You spoke with Linda Christman last week about the Bismarck Art and Galleries Association.
Right.
And today you're going to tell us about David Borlaug's operation.
Yes, the Capitol Gallery in downtown Bismarck is about fairly dramatic addition to the gallery scene, I would say, in Bismarck, North Dakota. And it has a different approach than the other galleries. David will talk about that as we discuss. And this was the first time I'd been able to be there. They've been open for a while, you know, and I just hadn't had the time when I was in Bismarck to drop in. And so I went in, and boy, they have a couple of very, very North Dakota-related shows. Very, very dramatically different shows. So David starts off by talking about one of them and then switches to the other. It's interesting.
Yeah, this is Kay Burian from Manning, North Dakota. And what we've done is bifurcated the gallery to create two different sets of lenses of how an artist might view our sense of place, our history, our culture, our landscape. And Kay Burian has been painting for 50-plus years, nationally recognized, does just the most beautiful, realistic, representational pieces of bison, horses, landscapes, cowboys, you name it. And they really represent who we are, our sense of place in the Old West, if you will. So that's half of the exhibit.
Yeah, and let's just look at this for a second. We've got a couple of old cowboys on horseback here exchanging words out in the prairie. Three bison, one who's looking very meaningfully toward us, the viewer, walking along a dusty yellow gold grass landscape. You've got some beautiful horses, a calf with fine blinking eyelashes on it. Very Western.
Her level of detail is just astounding, and that's what makes this the special art that it is.
Yeah, the hair on the horses.
You look at the bison, you look at the horses, and you can imagine her using a brush with a single hair on it to get the individual eyelids. And that's what brings life to a painting. It's what gives a painting personality, and it's why people love them so much and take them home.
So that's one side of the gallery. And then over here on the other side, I came in and saw this, and I thought, okay, here are these large paintings. Oh, this is really North Dakotan. There's Teddy Roosevelt. There's Sitting Bull. There's an eagle. There's a Native American in traditional clothing. And then I see, wait a minute, where are these artists from?
And they're from Nigeria. And, you know, great artists, they capture what they see around them. And so they are here in Lemon, South Dakota. They're ensconced at the Kokomo Inn Gallery, Jonathan Imbafador and Dotun Papula. Do this incredible mosaic artwork, but no, they're not doing what they have back home in Nigeria. They look around them and capture what they see in North and South Dakota. But they do it with a Nigerian, an African, Dakota fusion, if you will.
Yeah, it's striking, not something we see very often.
Well, we're looking at a piece called Powwow, and it's a beautiful young American Indian woman in regalia at a powwow. But if you look in the background, more subdued and dark in the background, are two very African-looking people with headdresses that look very African.
Yeah.
If you look at an image of General Custer, George Armstrong Custer, but look closely.
Yeah, let's walk over by that.
And you look at Custer, it's the stereotypical photograph that the whole world has seen of him, and yet when you look at the piece, you know, that's 60 by 42 inches, you'll see the entire border is rimmed with Indian petroglyphs. Who would think of that? And paired not with a Sitting Bull, but a Nigerian Bini chief. So there is the fusion. There's a longhorn steer, and it just has an effect that's completely different from what you might expect to see.
Now, you called these mosaic, but they're paintings. They're not mosaics, but they have a mosaic appearance because of the way both of these artists and several of the paintings have worked with segmenting almost like as much mosaic, I would say, stained glass.
Yeah, anyone who likes stained glass is drawn to it immediately. But Jonathan teaches this back in Nigeria at university, in fact. But it's an art form that uses acrylic on canvas, but then he textures it. You know, sort of like icing on a cake when you're putting it in a funnel and squeezing it through. But you get this layered effect. And then the use of color in a mosaic stained glass effect approach, really, is what makes them so unique. And the largest pieces are 6 feet by 4 feet. And I thought, oh my, you know, these are going to have to go in big bank lobbies or something. And you know what? We've sold 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and they are all going to private homes so far.
They're beautiful, and the technique and the expressiveness of the faces is so well realized with these beautiful glowing colors, and then this whole other level of all these shapes and the symbolic meanings. There's all kinds. If you look closer, you see shapes of this Sitting Bull on his vest. There's different figures there.
A meadowlark. I mean, who would do that?
Yeah.
A meadowlark perched on his shoulder, and yet there's a sacred symbolism within the tribal community about the meadowlark, and they know that. They've done their research.
Yeah, these two artists from Nigeria doing this. There was one that I saw that I wanted you to look at with me, David, that was very strikingly realistic and humorous. What's the name of this one?
They call it Fertility Dolls. It's one of Dotun's pieces. It's meant, the idea is, it looks like two cowgirls out in a rodeo grounds, hats on their heads, bedecked, and he painted it to kind of look like wind-up toys. But also, on you don't have to look too closely to see that they're rather topless. And with that, it's sort of a jab at that National Geographic stereotypical image of African women.
But these look like carved wooden ceremonial objects.
And so that's why he calls them fertility dolls, in the sense that they look like dolls or a wind-up toy or a caricature, if you will. But they're just so delightful, and as all great art does, it's the conversation starter for anybody that walks into the gallery.
I'll bet. And then next to it, here's a glowing painting, a grid of many different shapes, animals, sunshine, plants from the natural world, footprints and turtles, taking on an iconography that looks maybe like a traditional tribal drawings. And then in front of it, in silhouette, is a bird, a very dramatic bird.
Yeah, a raven, some carnivore bird with a hooked beak, very ominous, not sinister, but just a little ominous because of the black silhouette. You think Edgar Allan Poe or something right away. But then when you look at the imagery, that grid that you spoke of, again, it's that fusion. It's a blending of, bear tracks and a goose and a moose and a horse. But then you see
a frog and an ant.
But then you see things that look very African, too. An alligator, other reptiles, just funkiness abounds in it. And again, it's the kind of piece, we get asked a lot when people walk in, particularly more so with abstract art. They'll say, what's this supposed to say to me? What's it supposed to do for me? And the answer is, it does whatever you want it to do. It is what you see and how you feel when you see it. But one gentleman who was giving me that approach once, his wife, along with rolling her eyes at him, finally stopped him and said, it would bring the room to life. That's what that piece will do. And that is the beauty and the joy of great art. It transforms itself when you bring it into your home, but it also transforms your home.
Well, it's really a striking and fun show to see and stimulating to thought. How long is it up?
This show will be up through August. We'll switch over in September, and we'll shift gears, not quite so dramatically, but aesthetically certainly, with Indian Ledger art from Butch Thunderhawk and Monty Yellowbird. And that'll be our showing in September and October. But this will remain up through August, and we're open 6 days a week, 10 to 5. People know how to get a hold of me. I tend to show up after hours to give special showings because it's just such a joy, all that we have to offer here. And this is what our nonprofit foundation chose to do with a new mission, is bring something into the community. And by community, I mean all of North Dakota and beyond.
David Borlaug talking with our Bill Thomas. And Bill, it's a nice gallery, I take it.
Yeah. I think it's definitely worth a visit if you're in Bismarck, if you're in downtown Bismarck. It's easy to walk in, and they're very friendly, and it's just really good material, great to look at.
Well, let's talk about something else that you've been working on, because Prairie Public's got this Ask a Native American project. So where are we with that, and tell our listeners about it.
Well, we're signing people up for it. And the way this project works, it's not a big, great big public event. It's kind of a small event where we invite 8 people who are askers and 8 people who are answerers. And the answerers in this case are Native Americans. So some group that a lot of people might want to talk with, that might want to speak up for themselves. I'm sure we'll go on and do, if this one works out, we'll do ASCA, fill in the blank with a lot of other things as well. But this is the first one we're trying. So we're asking 8 Native Americans and 8 people who are not Native Americans but want to ask questions of Native Americans, to talk, have a conversation. We're not looking for people, to yell at each other. We're people who are curious and want to know. And we'll invite them to come together at 10 in the morning at the Heritage Center in Bismarck on August 11th, Saturday. And for a couple of hours, we'll have them paired up one-to-one, and then every few minutes, they'll switch.
Speed dating.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's speed dating, except the idea is to discuss meaningful things with each other. And then at the end, after everybody's had a chance to talk to everybody, we'll break and have lunch and talk and continue the discussion. And I'll be there trying to grab some interviews at that time so that we can hear about what happened on the radio. But a lot of it is just about what happens in the room. So it's going to be interesting. It's a new experiment for us.
So is anybody in the room besides the people meeting with each other?
Well, just Wanda Agnew, who lives in Bismarck and is a facilitator who's just kind of helping us run things. I'll be there, maybe one or two other people to help with the interviews afterwards. So it's not an audience, not like a panel audience kind of thing.
But this is something that our listeners might hear on Main Street eventually.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll hear pieces from it, and some of the people might want to come on and talk about it. I mean, the thing is, we know, Doug, you and I, as people who work in radio, we know that the interview situation that we get in gives us license to talk about things that, you know, it's just not really polite or good form to talk about when you're just standing next to somebody or you work with them or so on. And this is the same kind of thing. It'll give people license to talk about really meaningful things that they're curious about and have really good exchanges, we hope.
Where did this idea come from?
It came from KUOW in Seattle, another public radio station. They tried it. They thought it worked really well. And I know somebody there. He called me up and said, hey, we wonder if you'd want to try it too. So there's still, if people want to sign up to participate, there are still some slots open to be either an asker or answerer. You can go to prairiepublic.org or just give us a call at Prairie Public.
All right. Thank you, Bill Thomas. Natural North Dakota is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a familiar voice on Prairie Public. When he's not teaching biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, he writes and voices Natural North Dakota, a series of essays about the plant and animal life that live in our part of the world. Today, his subject is the American goldfinch.
I've been enjoying watching the goldfinches at our Niger feeder, as well as gracing the fields and meadows of the Turtle Mountains area recently. They're always a treat to watch. Noted ornithologist, naturalist, and bird guide author Roger Torrey Peterson must have had a soft spot for goldfinches when he described them by saying, and I quote here, "The responsibilities of life seem to rest lightly on the goldfinch's sunny shoulders," unquote. Arthur Cleveland Bent, in his Life Histories of Familiar North American Birds, also found them interesting, as he noted that the goldfinches are, and I quote again, "always in the best of spirits. It has a definite personality exemplifying lighthearted cheerfulness, restlessness, sociability, and untiring activity. Its flight is deeply undulating. It flies along as if riding on the waves of a stormy sea, giving, as it rises to each crest, its little phrases of four happy notes," unquote. That flight call is often described as a soft potato chip. Potato chip, potato chip, potato chip, potato chip. Goldfinches reign throughout the United States, southern Canada, and parts of Mexico. Their habitat is largely open country, such as fields, meadows, open forests, and backyards, in both rural and urban areas, particularly where thistles and other members of the aster family are important. It might surprise you, but while many young birds have already fledged, the goldfinches are approaching the middle of their nesting season. Robert Stewart, in his Breeding Birds of North Dakota, listed their breeding season as running from late June to mid-September. That's largely related to the seed production of thistles, which are an important food item as well as important material for their nests. Goldfinches nest in small trees or tall shrubs between 4 and 7 feet above the ground. The females construct an open cup of plant material lined with the down of thistles, milkweeds, and other fluffy seed material. If all goes well, she'll lay 4 to 6 pale bluish-white eggs, with perhaps some small light brown specks in the larger end. Incubation time is 12 to 14 days. Goldfinches are known to produce 1 or perhaps 2 broods per year. So if you see a few goldfinches as you travel about, take the time to watch these cheerful wild canaries for a few minutes. They'll undoubtedly brighten your day, literally and figuratively. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau, You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Next time on Studio 360.
We don't want children to get hurt.
Playground equipment is safer than ever.
But on the other hand, I think now we've gone too far and children aren't getting hurt, but they're also not being challenged, and then they don't want to go play.
How lawyers and bureaucrats ruin fun. Next time on Studio 360.
Tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for July 31st. William H. White was born on this date in 1851 in Vermont, and he was barely 21 years old when he moved to Moorhead, Minnesota from Brainerd and began a lumber business. The year was 1872, and the Northern Pacific Railroad was crossing the Red River into Dakota Territory. White was an enterprising young man, and he secured the railroad contract to supply timber for the approaches to the railroad bridge. But White's business ranged much farther. He took lumber by flatboats on the Red River to Grand Forks, Pembina, and other communities. In 1873, he opened a lumber yard in Bismarck, providing the materials for some of the first homes built in Bismarck, as well as the first newspaper plant in what would become North Dakota. In 1874, he moved to Fargo, where his headquarters became established. When he died in 1916, the William H. White Lumber Company had been the longest-running enterprise in North Dakota. He owned 24 lumber yards, mainly in the Red River Valley. But White's resume extended beyond lumber. He was a founder and director of the First National Bank of Fargo, and he helped organize the city's auditor and treasurer offices. He was said to be the first Methodist in North Dakota, and built the state's first Methodist Episcopalian church in 1874 in Fargo. He was on numerous boards of trustees and active in philanthropy and social life. He and his wife Anna traveled the world in their later years. When he died, his friend praised his role in state history, saying, "The business life of North Dakota felt his creative hand through all its plastic years, and the network of his business interests interlaces a large territory wherein he was respected and honored." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
North Korea returns what it says are the remains of American soldiers who died in the Korean War. But there are also reports of the North Korean military building new missiles.
North Korea's commitments to President Trump and Singapore were quite vague. They don't seem to be in any hurry to give up their weapons, which they depend on for their survival.
The state of diplomatic relations with North Korea on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, NDSU history professor Tom Ezern will discuss his new book, Pacing Dakota. And we'll talk with Fargo native Jennifer Baumgartner. She was once the youngest editor of Ms. Magazine. Now Baumgartner is the founder of Daughter Press, which takes a feminist approach to publishing and artistic production. Its first set of publications will launch in the fall. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.